AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. It's a bribery and kickback scandal in world soccer. There are two separate criminal investigations, one focusing on FIFA soccer tournaments played here in the U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch is talking about that this morning, saying that year after year, soccer officials sought bribes from sports marketing firms.
They were expected to uphold the rules that keep soccer honest and to protect the integrity of the game. Instead, they corrupted the business of worldwide soccer to serve their interests and to enrich themselves.
The other investigation has been opened by Swiss prosecutors who are looking into how the 2018 World Cup tournament was awarded to Russia and the 2022 World Cup tournament to Qatar. FIFA says those decisions will stand. The rain is still falling in Houston, which has had nearly a foot of rain in the past few days. Weather Service forecaster Paul Lewis.
If it continues doing this, it could be between 1 and 3 inches at least, and that will contribute to any further problems.
The number of missing in the Texas floods includes two people who were in a boat that capsized in Houston as they were helping with rescue efforts. Southwest of Dallas, water is flowing over the top of an earthen dam at a lake, and police say emergency personnel could shut down a highway nearby if that dam breaks. The Vatican Secretary of State is calling Ireland's vote to legalize gay marriage a defeat for humanity. Cardinal Pietro Parolin said he is saddened by the landslide decision, in which more than 62% of the Irish said yes, despite church teaching that marriage is only between a man and a woman. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair is stepping down from his post as the international community's Mideast envoy. This is AP Radio News. Nebraska is struggling with whether to abolish the death penalty. Lawmakers there have already decided to get rid of the death penalty, but Governor Pete Ricketts vetoed the bill. This afternoon, lawmakers are going to try to override that veto. Our Grant Schulte is in Lincoln, where he says the governor is trying to show that Nebraskans support the death penalty.
He took the unusual step of bringing in lawmakers, family members of people who were killed by some of the death row inmates, and law enforcement to try to bolster his case. So he was making a very public show of support to try to pressure lawmakers into sustaining his veto.
Unemployment rates fell in 23 states in April as hiring rebounded across the nation from weak job gains the previous month. The Labor Department says this morning 11 states reported a higher unemployment rate than in March. 16 saw no change. I'm Rita Foley, and this is AP Radio News.
Your top stories today on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The IRS shuts down part of its website after a criminal network got access to taxpayers' information. The Get Transcripts site lets users see their tax returns from prior years. IRS officials say hackers were able to download more than 100,000 taxpayer returns. A notice on the site says the online service is unavailable, but taxpayers can still get their transcripts through the mail. Federal employees in 13 cities will see a locality pay raise next January. The move comes after a 2013 Bureau of Labor Statistics report, finding feds in those cities make less money than their private sector counterparts. The Postal Service postpones dozens of facility closures, according to GovExec. The agency was going to close 82 facilities this year, but some lawmakers and postal unions are against the closures, saying they'll cost thousands of jobs. It's 4 minutes past the hour. I'm Shefali Kapadia.
Are you delaying retirement planning until after your first Botox treatment or comb-over? Well, this is Federal News Radio, senior correspondent Mike Causey. Lots of people, maybe most, think that retirement planning is for older folks, or maybe they won't ever be able to afford to retire. But the fact is, the sooner you start, the better. You know, the time to max out on your thrift savings plan contributions is now. Missing out on that government 5% match will cost you tens of thousands of dollars down the road. Money you'll need but won't have to spend. Also, there are the best date or dates to retire. Do you know how to maximize your final year's salary and get a tax break on your lump sum annual leave payment by leaving between December 31st and January 3rd? And how to get a pay raise on most of your unused annual leave? Did you know there are actually a dozen best dates to retire throughout the year? Sign up for my column and all our email alerts at federalnewsradio.com/alerts. I'm Mike Causey.
This hour of news is brought to you by Boeing, delivering the enduring capability and value of the FA-18 Super Hornet to the U.S. Navy on schedule and on budget. Learn more at fa-18.com.
Big results from big data? The challenge for government agencies is finding the balance between business intelligence and the security, complexity, and privacy risks inherent in big data. Join Federal News Radio's Tom Temin and Vion Corporation for the panel, Data-Driven Decision-Making in Government. Experts from industry and government will address techniques on how to manage the tsunami of information available from the Internet of Things and turn real-time data into actionable intelligence. Listen to Federal News Radio Thursday, June 4th at 10 a.m.
Welcome to Ask the Chief Human Capital Officer, brought to you by Management Concepts, unleashing the potential of individuals, teams, and organizations on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Every week, Federal News Radio interviews the CHCOs of federal agencies about the latest human capital directives, challenges, and successes.
Welcome to the program. My guest today is Joanne Torno. She's the head of the Office of Information and Resource Management and the Chief Human Capital Officer for the National Science Foundation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me. If you would, start by telling our listeners a little bit about the National Science Foundation and its mission.
I'd be delighted. The National Science Foundation is an independent agency of the federal government, and we were founded in 1950. Our mission, which we have kept since the founding of the agency in the organic legislation that set us up, is to promote the progress of science, to advance the national health, prosperity, and welfare, to secure the national defense, and for other purposes. So a very nice, focused little mission. The way we do this, the way we accomplish our mission, is that we basically fund fundamental research in science, engineering, and education, which is typically done by faculty at our colleges and universities across the country.
You've been at NSF for a while.
I have.
Tell us a little bit about your background, what you've done here, and then also just about your HR philosophy.
I have been at NSF for a while, but actually I'm pretty new in my role as Chief Human Capital Officer. I came to NSF a little over 15 and a half years ago as a program officer in the biological sciences. So my background is actually in molecular biology, and I had an academic career before I came to NSF. I was on the faculty at University of Southern Mississippi and taught genetics and molecular biology and conducted my own research in my lab at the university. I came to Washington actually 2 years before I came to NSF to work on science policy. So I had the opportunity to work for a year in the U.S. Senate and then to work for a year at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy before I came to the foundation. And I pretty much have spent my career in various positions, moving from program officer, where I was actually running the reviews of grant proposals and making funding decisions, into more administrative and senior management level positions in different parts of the foundation, but really pretty much primarily staying in the science research directorates. Last December, I moved over to the Office of Information and Resource Management, which is where I am now, and became the Chief Human Capital Officer. So I am new to that position, but I think that my career at NSF was ultimately leading to this role. As I took on different responsibilities at NSF, more and more I found that I was focusing on the employees, the staff at NSF, and how we can improve the operations of the agency so that we can become more effective at accomplishing our mission. And OIRM, that is what we do. That is the place that I can make the biggest contribution to NSF and through really thinking about the welfare of our employees and also thinking about how we can do our business operations in as effective a manner as possible.
Were there any driving factors that really moved you to take on that additional role as the human resources officer?
Actually, my position is broader than human resources. Human resources is a major piece as the chief human capital officer, but within my office there's actually three divisions. So human resource management is one, information technology systems is another, and our administrative services, taking care of the building, is another, which is a very broad remit, really. I saw this as really a great opportunity to first have a different challenge for myself, but also to make a contribution to the agency. I found that over time, when you first started NSF as a program officer, you're focusing a lot on the science and the community, and often it's a very external focus. The longer I've been at NSF, and I find this is true for many of my colleagues, the more we focus on the agency itself. There's a devotion to the agency that I see here. The staff are really dedicated and grow to love this agency. And so that is where I think my focus has moved. And so coming here and being able to really focus on those aspects that are the strength of the agency is what attracted me to the position.
Can you give us a picture of the workforce at NSF? Who are they? Where are they?
Absolutely.
How many are there?
Which is a moving target. As I mentioned, we're an independent agency. We're smaller. We do participate in the Small Agency Council, though we're on the big side when you start to think about small agencies. We have in the neighborhood of around 1,500 federal employees, and there are a number of several hundred contractors that round us out to around 2,000 or so. In fact, we just did a little story about the demographics of our workforce. We're about 59% female. We're about 26% African American, 3% Hispanic, and 9% Asian. We are heavily representing the sciences and engineering, so the science, technology, engineering, or math, which is STEM, so I'm just going to refer to it as STEM from now on. Not quite half of our workforce are in the STEM area, so they come with some sort of technical qualification in one of those areas. We also have a very robust rotator program. So we have 1,500 employees, but in the neighborhood of 300 or so are here on temporary appointments. So they come, we bring people in, these are primarily in the programmatic ranks, in the science ranks. We bring people in from the universities to work here at NSF at various different levels. They bring with them the firsthand knowledge of where the science, engineering, education opportunities are, where the challenges are, and are constantly infusing the agency with new ideas and new energy. And pairing them with career employees who have a sense of the long view and the horizon and understand where NSF operates within the federal government, we find to be a very powerful way to build a workforce for us to accomplish our mission.
We need to pause for a short break. You're listening to Joanne Torno of the National Science Foundation on Ask the Chico at federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Complex, volatile, unpredictable. When your organization operates in these kinds of environments, linking your human capital strategy to organizational objectives is essential to achieve business results. At Management Concepts, their experts partner with stakeholders across your organization to create strategic human capital solutions that drive individual, team, and organizational performance. You have a vision for your organization. Management Concepts can help you achieve it. Learn more at managementconcepts.com/radio.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Lauren Larson. My guest today is Joanne Torno. She's head of the Office of Information and Resource Management and Chief Human Capital Officer for the National Science Foundation. What are the biggest challenges you've encountered so far?
Well, that's a big question. In my role as CHICO, I think is where I'll go. We'll start with that question. The biggest challenges I think that we have right now for our workforce is, well, a few different things. One is workload. I think that that's on everybody's mind here at NSF. Over the last several years, there has really been an increase in the work, in the number of proposals that come to the agency, in the work that we are asking our staff to do. One of the things that I should mention about NSF is that 94%, I believe, of the funds to the agency go out the door to the scientific community, either to support research, building of critical infrastructure, or various educational training programs that we support. We have a very lean operation in terms of the staff. So we're only 6% of the funds that come to the agency are in overhead. And that means that we are always looking for ways to do our work as efficient a way as we can without sacrificing the quality of the work. NSF takes the credibility of our process very seriously, which requires a dedication to carrying out all the parts of the process and not cutting any corners. And so that creates a workload stress for most of the agency. I think that's compounded a little bit right now for NSF because we are in the process of constructing a new building for the agency. Really, developers constructing the building will be leasing it. The agency will be moving. We will be leaving our neighborhood where we are right now in Arlington, Virginia, and be moving to Alexandria within the next couple of years. And so there's uncertainties there. Change is always difficult. So that creates stress for the workforce as well. So I think that that's sort of the challenge right now with the current workforce. One of the other challenges we face is related, actually. It's the sort of the plus minus of having a rotator program is that there's a high demand on recruiting and training new staff that are always coming through. At the same time that it brings a vibrancy to the agency and fresh ideas on a really sort of powerful pairing of longevity and of, you know, really recency, I think that there's a challenge in making sure that we're always refreshing and training the folks that come in. They come in from the university, and a government agency is a little bit different than a university environment, and keeping up with that can be challenging as well.
You mentioned the people who rotate through. Mm-hmm. What kind of effect does that have on the workplace culture, and how do you, when there's people always rotating in and out, and I know that scientists sometimes have strong personalities, so how do you sort of maintain a healthy workplace culture when it's always changing like that?
That's a great question, and that's one that we think about all the time, because we do want to have the experience of working at NSF be as positive a one as possible for the rotators coming in. We also want it to minimize the disruption to the career staff who are here and who are always seeing new people come and go. One of the things that we do as much as we can is pair people. So the biggest part of our rotating workforce are our program officers. And when they come in any one division, we're really trying for a balance of about in the neighborhood of 50-50 of permanent to rotator. Maybe it's a little bit higher permanent to rotator. But that allows us to make sure that you have, that people work together in groups, and so you have the ability to have some stability provided by the permanent folks and with the new ideas, you know, sort of coming in from the rotators. And also by pairing them in groups and in teams, then people can create relationships and networks that help really bridge that difference about how new they are to the agency or whether or not they've been here for years. So that's sort of a key part to having that work successfully, is having a way to bring a rotator in smoothly. We have developed a number of different training opportunities for onboarding our rotators to make sure that they understand the process that they're coming into, and then also having the opportunity to have people be mentored. We have a new mentoring program that we have started a couple of years ago, which I think has been going very well. The participation in the mentoring program goes up every year. So those are some ideas of what we do to try to help to take advantage of the pluses of having a lot of rotation while minimizing some of the disruptions of it.
You mentioned the move. How are you preparing for that from a workforce perspective?
We have been actually preparing for this for a couple of years. So NSF moved out to Arlington about 20 years ago or so, give or take. And there are actually some folks here at the agency now who went through that prior move and can have shared some of their experiences of what the challenges were in moving. We were in downtown Washington, D.C., and now moved out to Arlington. At that time, which we're also seeing now, is that folks who are possibly thinking about retiring, well, the move seems to be helping to have them make up their minds. And we are seeing a bit of a surge in retirements even now, when we're still a couple of years out from the move. So that's the challenge, and we've been preparing for it, thinking more about succession planning. We've been really sort of doing a lot of analysis of the part of the workforce that is eligible to retire, and think about how we could do good succession planning so we don't have big gaps in the knowledge when, you know, good, talented, experienced folks walk out the door. There's a lot of knowledge that goes with them. We have been participating in, you know, bringing some folks back who've retired to help with transitions. We are looking to develop a program that would allow us to participate in the phased retirement opportunity. We're hoping that we're going to be able to institute that in within the next several months. And otherwise, we're also just trying to engage the workforce in the move itself so that we can have people feel some connection to it, so that when the move comes, it's not a negative. We can look forward to it as a positive. You know, as I say, change is hard. It's going to change commutes for some folks, for sure. It's going to make it better for others. And so we are also looking at all those other kinds of impacts on our employees now so that we can think about how to mitigate any of the potentially negative impacts that the move will cause.
Now, will these offices be smaller? I know a lot of people are going to that smaller office. You know, everyone's in tight and more people are teleworking, so it makes sense. Is it going to be a big change physically for people?
Well, I think it will be a big change physically, but not necessarily in the way you've just described. So the building is being built as we speak. So we'll be moving into a brand new building. And there are some advantages to that because we are having an opportunity to have some input into the design of the internal spaces. We have been negotiating with our union about office workstations and spaces and so on. And we have all of the spaces for everybody, including the senior leadership and executives, is going to be smaller in the new building, but not dramatically smaller. We're not moving to an open floor plan, for example. I think that we've tried to consider both the quality of space for the employee as well as the amount of space for the employee. So there's a lot of things we're going to be able to do, I think, in amenities that'll be in the workspaces themselves that will make the whole environment positive. That is our goal in any event.
We'll pause again for a short break. I'm speaking with Joanne Torno of the National Science Foundation on Ask the Chico at federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Management Concepts, the premier provider of professional development and talent management solutions for the public sector, can help you shape your federal HR career with updated human capital and human resources training. These courses provide both the functional and strategic skills demanded by the rapidly changing field of federal HR. Get an intensive 5-day HR overview in the new HR Boot Camp. Learn more at managementconcepts.com/radio. managementconcepts.com/radio.
Welcome back. I'm Lauren Larson. My guest today is Joanne Torno. She's the head of the Office of Information and Resource Management and the Chief Human Capital Officer for the National Science Foundation. What are some of the challenges that come along with recruiting the top scientific minds?
One of the challenges in thinking about recruiting scientists who are leading in their field, as I mentioned earlier, working at a government agency is different than being in a university. Most scientists are independent souls, and that's what the field basically selects for. There is more of a move towards team science now, but many researchers really are running their own show and really have the independence and can move in whatever direction they're interested in going in. When you come into a government agency, even though I think NSF is a pretty flexible workplace, there are still some constraints around what one can and cannot do. There's regulations, there's conflicts rules, and things like that. And so having somebody make that transition, we work hard to help them make it as smooth as possible. But that sometimes is a challenge to make that attractive to an academic scientist leaving their academic environment to come to work in Washington in a government agency. I also think that depending on the field, there are some fields of science and engineering where working at NSF is something they aspire to. So there's actually in some communities where, and this is I think related to the degree to which NSF is their major financial support, they look upon a position at NSF as something that is a feather in their cap. And we find that most of the people who do come to NSF, when they go back to their institutions, they are actually positioned to move on to other kinds of higher level positions, if you will, if you want in university administration. There are other communities where NSF is one of many that supports them, and it's not even on their radar screen. It's not that they think it would not be of interest, but it's not even something that occurs to them. And so making sure that we get out there and let them know that we're not only interested in having rotators, but it's a great experience when they come, that there's real benefits to spending a little time at NSF and having the opportunity to get a much broader perspective of the R&D environment and being able to actually have some influence on the direction that some of the science agendas move. That's a pretty exciting thing. So I think that the other thing that we find challenging is that our rotator program rotates, right? So folks come and then they go back to their careers. And convincing folks that it's going to be possible to take that hiatus from their research careers can sometimes be a bit of a challenge. Many fields research, especially for the top folks in their field, it's competitive. And losing the time, if you will, to step away from that for a while to come to an agency to work, that can be people really weigh that pretty heavily. NSF does do what we can to help them stay connected to their research so that they do have a career to go back to when they leave us. But that I think those are some of the, we are asking people to take a bit of a hiatus from their careers to come to NSF. And so the timing that it's going to work for them and us, it has to be just right. But I think we do this all the time. And so there's things that we have been working on now to be a little bit more proactive in the social media side, using LinkedIn and various other mechanisms to expand the reach of NSF and in order to attract strong scientists and engineers to the agency, has been pretty successful.
We are almost out of time. Any final thoughts?
I do want to say, I think that working at NSF has been a wonderful experience. Not only because of the work that we do, but because it is a public service. I really do feel that the work that I do, the work that all of us do here at NSF, makes a difference in the world, and that we are able to do work that we love and have it contribute to society at large is just a wonderful thing. My colleagues here at NSF are really dedicated public servants. I am always, every day, impressed by the motivation that they have to carry out the mission of the agency and make a contribution to this country. And so I'm very proud to be here at NSF.
That's all the time we have today. I'd like to thank my guest, Head of the Office of Information and Resource Management and Chief Human Capital Officer for the National Science Foundation, Joanne Torno. I'm Lauren Larson. Be sure to tune in next time. And check out any interviews you may have missed at federalnewsradio.com/CHCO. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Human Capital Officer, brought to you by Management Concepts, unleashing the potential of individuals, teams, and organizations on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com/CHCO, Wednesday mornings at 11 a.m., only on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. WFED, your source for federal news now.
imagine your agency empowered with knowledge that provides the ability to visualize and analyze big data with a single interface. TIBCO enables multiple federal agencies to access and assemble unstructured, human-generated, text-based information from any source and in any format. So your agency will receive a new level of real-time responsiveness to protect and serve, all while leveraging existing IT investments. Learn more about TIBCO at TIBCO.com/government. That's TIBCO.com/government.
Presented by the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce and the Professional Services Council, the Greater Washington Government Contractor Awards is the premier event honoring the leadership, innovation, and commitment to excellence of the people and businesses in the region's government contracting community. Now is the time for you to nominate a contractor or executive of the year for 2015. Visit fairfaxchamber.org to submit your nomination today. The Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business in Northern Virginia.
Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, learn how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 9, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help breathe life into federal IT policy. And at 11, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO to hear from your agency's top tech leader how technology is changing government. Tech Tuesday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You know, the mantra in Washington is follow the money. Everybody says it, hardly anybody does it. But we do. Every week on Your Turn with Mike Causey. Whether it's your pay raise, a major change to your retirement package, or the chances of layoffs, we're on it. Because we really do follow the money, and it's your money. Give us a listen Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., or download it anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Your Turn.
Federal News Radio's DoD Wednesday. At 3, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, a discussion with senior managers about how the department meets its mission. At 4, in-depth host Francis Rose brings you Pentagon Solutions, a smart discussion on the issues and challenges of the defense community, plus daily DoD updates mornings and afternoons, Monday through Friday. DoD Wednesday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show today are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington Columnist for The Economist. Here are the issues. In a matter of days, Islamic State, the extremist group, captured Ramadi in Iraq and Palmyra in Syria, a city with 2,000-year-old archaeological treasures. In Washington, hundreds of documents taken from Osama bin Laden's residence in Pakistan were released publicly. Meanwhile, Bill and Hillary Clinton in 2014 earned $26 million in speeches, money donated to their foundation. Barbara, let's start with what I think most people think are significant losses in Iraq and Syria, yet the Obama administration says, no, we're not losing this war.
Well, President Obama called these the losses a setback, which I guess is a good euphemism for what was obviously a disastrous bunch of days. Mm-hmm. You know, the administration line is that Islamic State has been contained, that they're being slowly pushed back, that the administration has a strategy for dealing with this group. But obviously, the Islamic State has its own strategy, and they are very successful still in Sunni Muslim areas of Iraq, like Ramadi, where they had controlled part of the city for quite a long time, but they were able to take over the rest of it using suicide bombers, apparently 30 suicide bombs that combined with a sandstorm that kept Americans from bombing the place, sapped the morale of the Iraqi forces there and led them to an orderly retreat. Now, this is the other thing the administration is saying. The outgoing chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Martin Dempsey, says they drove out. They were not driven out. Well, I think that's small comfort to the Iraqi government. In Syria, you have another kind of dynamic. You have Palmyra in the desert, where government forces were not present in large numbers. It was apparently an easy win for the Islamic State. As you point out,
they now could destroy, loot, sell one of the most precious archaeological sites in the world. I had the good fortune to actually go there in 1999 and see it. So, you know, I count myself among the lucky few, because there may be many who don't have that possibility in the future.
Well, what do you say, David?
Well, Fred, the question that you asked Barbara just now was, how can the Americans say we are not losing this war?
Mm-hmm.
I suspect, in fact, I know, because I spent the week talking to senior administration officials about this stuff, they would challenge the premise of your question. They would say, why is it America that is losing or winning this war? This is not America's war. And that's a very important point. I mean, it may be that the rest of the world says the rise of ISIS is directly due to things that previous American governments did, like invade Iraq. But fundamentally, Barack Obama does not believe that America's job is to defeat ISIS. He believes that it is for the Sunni Muslims on the ground to defeat their extremist Sunni cousins, and that it is only the Iraqi government and the tribes that can do this job. And I think he would contest the idea that America fails when ISIS wins. Now, that's being clever here.
Well, that's a fine point.
That's being clever here because, you know, America is...
I'd call that an excuse.
Well, it's not black and white, is it? I mean, I think, you know, it is the case that it is not American ground troops are not going to go in and fight a war with 200,000, 300,000 American ground troops to sort this out. This is going to have to be a conflict in the region. It's also the case that, you know, when bad things happen somewhere in the world, it is not automatically the fault of the American president that those bad things are happening.
That's true.
But it is also the case, clearly, that America has more ability than anyone else to supply arms and training and to put its thumb on the scales if it says it sees an interest in ISIS losing. And there you can see, at the very least, a lack of a very clear strategy. There's lots of American promises and explanations about why it would be a good thing to train more and to provide more arms. And even those promises and sort of plans don't seem to be happening. That's clearly legitimate.
Okay, I'll rephrase taking your complaint into under advisement. I'll rephrase the question. Is ISIS winning?
Well, I mean, so someone I was talking to this week who has up-to-date live intelligence from the battlefield inside the government here was full of kind of interesting excuses. So Ramadi was a tactical setback. They talked, as Barbara said, about the sandstorm. They talked about the fact that the Iraqi army forces near Ramadi had not been resupplied properly by their own government and headquarters, so they were in a kind of demoralized, exhausted state. There's even talk about how people were distracted by the need to protect some pilgrimages, and ISIS was opportunistic. It's pretty skilled at seizing its moment. On the other hand, they say, if you look at some of the stuff happening in Syria, we should give more credit to the Kurdish fighters up near the Syria-Turkish border, who are apparently having some successes. The Americans point to those. They point to the success of the Kurdish fighters in the northern areas of Kurdistan in Iraq. So they try and say, you know, ISIS is winning some, losing some. It's a fluid situation. They're very opportunistic. But there are some, you know, there are some good things happening. I think the big picture is we can all agree that there isn't a clear plan for achieving the ambition of destroying ISIS.
Barbara, you can respond to that, but also I still don't understand how ISIS, with, what, roughly 20,000 troops, has been so successful against Iraqi militia, the Iraqi army, which doesn't seem to much, some Americans, anyway.
You put your finger on something. I mean, part of the problem, certainly, well, it's true in both Syria and Iraq, in terms of confusion about who's our friend and who the United States wants to be involved. There was a battle for Tikrit, which was being led by Shia militias that are close to Iran. And they got bogged down. They weren't able to complete the fight. And the United States told the Iraqi government that you get those militias out of the way, you bring in, you know, forces that are under your control, and we will provide air support and we will help you win this battle. And that's what the U.S. did. So that's sort of the model now for how the United States is supposed to operate. But it didn't work in Tikrit. The Iraqi troops left, and the militias had not been mobilized to come and take their place. So we have this huge problem where sometimes it's okay for the Shiite militias to take part, sometimes it's not. The United States is terrified that this will alienate the Sunnis even more in Iraq. Meanwhile, the Iraqi parliament has yet to pass a law that would allow formation of National Guard units, localized National Guard units, which in the case of Anbar province, Ramadi is the capital of Anbar province, would be Sunni National Guardsmen. So that force has not yet been stood up. So there's, for now, the U.S. and the Iraqi government really does still have to rely to a great extent on these Shia militias. And that's an uncomfortable fact that makes winning the broader war even harder.
It's time now for a short break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com for 50 years helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and David Rennie. And isn't it true that it is very difficult to get Sunnis who live in Anbar province to fight ISIS, who are also Sunnis?
Yeah, absolutely. When their concern is that all they're doing is strengthening a Shiite government in Baghdad that is supported by Iran. You know, that's why Iraq may not hold together as a country, ultimately. And I think we go back to David's point, which is that the United States can try to help the government in Baghdad and to somehow, after all the blood, sweat, tears that the U.S. has poured into this country over the years, try to keep something standing there. But ultimately, American soldiers are not going back to fight and die for Ramadi again.
And I think there's a really important point here, mm-hmm. which is, you know, people outside the United States, I think, need to understand public opinion, even the mood inside Congress. This is not the America of 10 years ago, where lots of members of Congress and lots of Americans, particularly conservative Americans, had big ambitions to reshape the Middle East, to make countries in the Middle East more like Western democracies. You can criticize the Obama administration, and should, for a lack of a clear strategy. But the truth is, I don't think American public opinion really knows what it wants either. You know, basically, most Americans were galvanized by the sight of ISIS extremists cutting the heads of Americans off last year. Up until that point, American TV news pictures of horrendous civilian losses in Syria and terrible scenes in the Civil War basically, I'm afraid, left Americans cold because Americans are done with trying to fix the Middle East. They have very, very low expectations about how much America can do to make these into nice, friendly countries. They're very cynical about what is seen here as a lack of gratitude in the Muslim world for everything America has done. That maybe that's seen completely differently in the Muslim world. But Americans basically, I think, have very low ambitions. And basically what they want is to stop ISIS from threatening America and to stop them cutting the heads off Americans. But that's kind of it. The neocons that people remember from 10 years ago, mm-hmm. they're done. They are just not a force. There isn't a kind of remake and bring democracy to the Middle East party in this town.
You know, the suggestions to reform or rebuild or strengthen the policy in Iraq now, I think suggests that with 10,000 more troops on top of the 3,000 that are already there, with the new troops being allowed to be a part of Iraqi militia units, the chances of success would be much greater.
You know,
I happen to think that Americans would support that, not a huge influx of troops as we had back 10 years ago.
They would, but I think also people are concerned about mission creep and people are concerned mm-hmm. about, you know, we've heard this story before mm-hmm. and then they end up being more than advisors and they end up, you know, staying longer. And then you've got this very odd kind of parallel debate here, which is a debate about President Obama, which is dressed up as a debate about the Middle East and policy. But fundamentally, by far the most potent, powerful lines for President Obama's critics in this town is to say, the reason the world looks like a terrible mess is because President Obama is a feckless, weak leader who doesn't believe in America's kind of moral force as a sort of shining city on a hill. And it sounds like a debate about the Middle East, but it isn't really. It's a political argument about whether Barack Obama loves America enough. And I think the number of people in this town really with concrete ideas as to how to make the Middle East better is a depressingly small number.
Yeah, Barbara, do you agree with that? I don't, but I'll let you
respond. I think that's part of it. But, mm-hmm. you know, I also know a lot of people who like President Obama who were just very concerned, for example, that the U.S. missed an opportunity in Syria 3 years ago mm-hmm. to strengthen moderate opposition forces. And it was a very interesting report from the Defense Intelligence Agency from 2012 that was declassified a couple of days ago that actually predicted everything that we've seen. It predicted the rise of what was then al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was the precursor of the Islamic State, predicted that it would return to its old pockets in Mosul and Ramadi and declare an Islamic State through union with other terrorist organizations operations in Iraq and Syria. That was in 2012. This
Brilliant.
Prediction was made.
Mm-hmm.
So the intelligence community knew what was happening. Now, the question is, could the United States have done anything at that time that would have prevented this? You know, I think Obama was never going to get American troops heavily involved, but there is an argument, and it will continue, over whether more support for the so-called moderates and, you know, a no-fly zone in Syria might have changed the dynamic at that time.
I totally agree with Barbara. Two things. I totally agree that you should criticize President Obama for messing up Syria policy. I think there is a completely legitimate kind of debate and among the foreign policy establishment and the think tanks and the elite kind of bubble in Washington. That debate is there. I guess what I'm trying to explain to listeners outside America is the nation, the bigger public opinion and the bigger political debate, to an extent that I find depressing, isn't really a debate about how can America, the last superpower, you know, fix the Middle East. That's just not where American politics is right now.
Mm-hmm. Let me, you all have mentioned President Obama. Here's what he said on December 14th, 2011, just before the final American troops were taken out of Iraq. He said, "We are leaving behind a sovereign, stable, and self-reliant Iraq with a representative government that was elected by its people." He called it a moment of success. Mm. Having said that, what responsibility does the United States, whether President Obama or his administration or just the country as a whole, bear for what's happened in Iraq now?
I think a lot. Clearly huge. But okay. I mean, you have to also be reasonable and bipartisan in your criticism that there's another administration that also bears responsibility for what's happening in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, it's called the George W. Bush administration.
Was President Obama wrong when he said that in 2011?
President Obama was being a politician. He had won election handsomely by promising to leave Iraq. He was making a ridiculously positive case for what he was leaving behind because his primary political impulse was to leave. And let's not forget, he was cheered to the rafters by the American people for leaving. And he was putting a sort of a ridiculously optimistic spin on the departure.
Yeah, and Fred, he was elected to get out of Iraq.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't elected necessarily to get out even the residual force that his administration had and earlier administrations had said they wanted to have there. So,
I mean, the reason that there wasn't a residual force was partly he didn't want to and partly because the Iraqi parliament, let's not forget, was not willing to let them stay.
All right, we'll be back in just a minute.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
We're back. I'm with Barbara Slavin and David Rennie. Palmyra, you've corrected me on that nicely. What about it? Why is it so important, other than all the great archaeological treasures?
Well, yeah, there's magnificent colonnade. There's an entire Roman city there that is, you know, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, all the rest of that. But it's also, the modern city is Tadmor, and there's an airbase there, and there's a highway that runs through it. It's sort of central in Syria, and from there you can go north to Aleppo, you can go west to the coast, you can go down to Damascus, and it's this highway apparently that leads also to the Assad regime's last holdout in the east of Syria, a place called Deir ez-Zor. So without access to the highway, they'll have trouble resupplying troops there, and Deir ez-Zor is likely to fall as well, and this will allow the Islamic State to consolidate this huge hunk of mostly desert, but you know, almost half of Syria, and then a big chunk of Iraq as well. So it's access to the highway. It also sits very close to Syrian natural gas deposits and pipelines, which will be another source of revenue, which means they can pay more foreign fighters.
Does this really, the capture of Palmyra, is this a tipping point against the Assad regime?
I don't know. I mean, that's the bigger question, because at the same time the Islamic State is gaining strength, of course, the Assad regime is losing strength. It's hollowing out. And, you know, the real question is, does the international community have anything to replace the Assad regime if somebody, you know, puts a bullet through his brain?
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that people are thinking about that now.
All right, the bin Laden documents, hundreds were released, David. And I think there are many hundreds of thousands more, but anyway, hundreds were released. One thing I think that we learned from it is that Osama bin Laden, even in his hideaway in Pakistan, was still really in charge of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, and there was, you know, occasionally sort of looks like the kind of CEO of a multinational, kind of grumbling about, you know, various kind of regional affiliates and management sort of issues that he was trying to face. But at the same time, if you look at his bookshelf and you assume that most of the things on his bookshelf belong to him, he was also someone who was at once surprisingly in touch with what was going on and getting, you know, up-to-date information and reading Western media sources and
adding books to him. But not The Economist.
Not The Economist, which The Economist is quite relieved about, I think. But at the same time, completely detached from reality. I mean, he had on his bookshelf, and this is one of the weirdest things, a few books which suggested that 9/11 was a conspiracy cooked up by the Americans, cooked up by the Israelis, you know, these very, very outlandish conspiracy books. You would have thought that he wasn't in the market for those. I mean, he kind of knew that 9/11 was him. So, but somehow, you know, I think this shows what a strange kind of bubble of weirdness he lived in. Mm-hmm. He was up for a bit of a conspiracy theory about who did 9/11.
Yeah, Barbara, what do you make of these documents?
Yeah, well, I see the more human side of, mm-hmm. of him. I mean, he was missing his third wife, who apparently... And a son who had found refuge in Iran, and he wanted them back with him. And so he wrote letters to her saying, you know, I'm going to have to leave Abbottabad. I'm going to have to find another place so we can all be together. I mean, you get a sense of somebody who, he was the leader of this terrorist organization, but also a human being who wanted his family around him and who was, in a sense, a captive. Of his own making in this compound where he had two Pakistanis who made sure he did not go out.
Was there any indication from these limited documents that Al-Qaeda was in decline, Barbara?
You know, I think there were earlier documents that were released that suggested some frustration about an inability to pull off other major attacks, and also documents I remember that were released a couple of years ago that showed differences with Iran. Which, a very uneasy relationship with the Iranians who were holding on to his wife, some others, one of his sons, you know, as essentially captives there for leverage against Iran. And, you know, we've seen glimmers of his management of international relations before. But I would agree that the bookshelf was perhaps the most interesting part.
I mean, actually, some of the most interesting documents were the ones released earlier where he was talking to the people who were essentially the founders of ISIS. And he was telling them to cut it out. You know, he and some of his deputies were saying to them, will you stop cutting people's heads off on video? You know, this is not winning us any allies here. You know, cut it out. Don't do that. You know, kill them some other way. Or particularly interesting, Al-Qaeda leadership telling the sort of embryonic leadership of ISIS, don't declare an Islamic caliphate. Don't declare an Islamic state. It's too soon. You know, consolidate a bit. Don't do this stuff. So, you know, we're not going to dress up Osama bin Laden as this kind of lovelorn management guy kind of, you know, tearing his hair out about the young terrorists. He was a psychotic. And if he missed his family, there's plenty of other families who missed their families because he killed them.
But it appears from that he was politically astute.
He was less crazy than ISIS. Okay. I think that we can say with some confidence.
That's one way of putting it. Barbara, we're going to turn to the Clintons here, Bill and Hillary, earning $26 million in speeches I think I said 2014, but this year. I think.
No, I think it's over a slightly longer period.
Well, whatever
it's over a slightly longer period. But it's part of this whole controversy over how much money, you know, the Clinton family has brought in for themselves personally and for the foundation. This particular trove was not earlier declared because it was just donated to the foundation. And so it was counted as revenue, not as donations. But when you look at where the money comes from for the speeches, I think that's what worries you. There was a Nigerian newspaper group that gave $500,000 for a speech by Bill Clinton. A Chinese holding company, another $500,000 to Bill Clinton. Citibank paid $250,000 for Hillary to give a speech. A foundation in Mexico run by the gazillionaire Carlos Slim gave $250,000 to Hillary. And you have to ask yourself, you know, is there going to be, if Hillary becomes president, any sort of residual gratitude toward countries, toward, you know, companies, because of the largesse that they show the Clinton Foundation. And, you know, the Clinton family will argue, no, all this money went for, you know, wonderful causes, treating HIV/AIDS, you know, helping children, all the rest. But is it just the way the world works now? I don't know.
I think the problem is that it is the way the world works for people who have been senior politicians and then retire. And there's a money door. You walk through the money door from the White House into the world of ex-presidents or ex-prime ministers like Tony Blair of the UK. You go through the money door, and then everyone kind of understands a bit queasily that you will live this strange life, sort of flying on other people's private jets to conferences on mountaintops and giving, you know, anodyne speeches about the 21st century and getting paid $500,000 for your anodyne speech. The problem that Hillary Clinton has, I think, is that she is trying something very unusual, which is to come the wrong way through the money door. That money door, I think, is a one-way money door for most people. We just about understand that people like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair and maybe in the future Barack Obama will walk through that door and they'll go into this slightly strange life. She walked through that door with Bill, and she's now trying to come back and become a public servant again. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the problem. We're in uncharted waters here.
Well, then there's the problem of whether the foundation has disclosed all the money that's come in and whether that fit with the State Department agreement and so on. It's a complicated issue that doesn't seem to go away, but we are going to go away because that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
Let's get moving. Join the National Parkinson Foundation on Moving Day. A day to walk, dance, stretch, move, and celebrate. Join the movement in your community and help defeat Parkinson's nationwide. People who move change the world. Moving
Day! In D.C. at the National Mall on Sunday, June 7th. Register today at movingdaydc.org. That's movingdaydc.org.
Acquisition and Industry Thursday on Federal News Radio. At 3, listen for the Coalition for Government Procurement's Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron. Federal contracting experts from both inside and outside of government give their views on the intersection of procurement policy and process and hear from companies themselves on policy, regulations, and trends on Industry Chatter with Francis Rose, Thursdays at 4. Acquisition and Industry Thursday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
800 million smartphones, 300 million tablets. Put that mix into the cloud, and it's a perfect storm for federal IT professionals. This is John Gilroy, host of Federal Tech Talk. In my 400 interviews with federal CIOs, small tech leaders, and big company CTOs, they always answer the question, how will this make life easier for the federal audience? Hear it live Tuesday mornings at 9 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, or download it anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Federal Tech Talk.
Management Friday on Federal News Radio. Friday mornings at 10, Aileen Black and Gigi Shum host Women of Washington. Hear from Washington, D.C.'s ambitious and influential female executives, role models for the next generation Washington leader. Then at 11, Shaw, Bransford, and Roth talk about the legal implications of management decisions on Fed Talk. And at noon, listen for Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch to learn the best career path for you. Management Friday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 68. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
This afternoon on In Depth with Francis Rose, building tomorrow's intelligence workforce is the task for Kathy Hudson and Nick Vassilopoulos of the National Security Agency. They'll tell you how they're already doing it. And your agency's human capital management is still on GAO's high-risk list. Congress just asked the GAO's Yvonne Jones for an update. She'll tell you what she told them. That and more on In Depth with Francis Rose this afternoon starting at 4 on Federal News Radio.
Sign up for Mike Causey's daily email for quick access to Mike's columns and the latest workforce news. Search alerts at federalnewsradio.com to sign up today.
WFED Washington, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick.
This paid. This-